This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, Attorney Jeff Haas joins us for the latest dispatch on the Dakota Access Pipeline protests.
As winter is setting in and 1,000 people are in the camp, including representatives from 180 Native American tribes in Canada, United States of America, and Latin America, the pipeline company and their security people, the government that supports them, the police behind them, are escalating their attacks against the water protectors.
As part of our coverage of non-establishment presidential candidates, we'll talk with Gloria LaRiva.
Stay tuned, because on our show, you'll learn something that the corporate media will never broadcast.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The battle over the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline continues. 2 weeks ago, the Federal Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. dissolved the injunction against the company which is building the pipeline. They plan to complete construction of the 1,172-mile subterranean pipeline, which will go from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota through South Dakota, Iowa, and into Illinois. It is 30 inches wide and will carry 470,000 barrels of crude oil a day underneath the Missouri River and through the sacred land of the Standing Rock Sioux Indian burial grounds. 22% of the pipeline is already completed, although the Army Corps of Engineers has placed a stay on that part of the pipeline passing through the land it controls, which borders both sides of the Missouri River. If the pipe breaks, which is common, the drinking water of some 15 million people will be imperiled. Knowing this, the government and the pipeline company changed its plans to have the pipeline pass close to the large city of Bismarck, North Dakota, and instead rerouted it through the Indian lands in violation of several treaties with the Sioux Indians and international law regarding the rights of indigenous people. Representatives of some 180 indigenous tribes from the United States of America, Canada, and Latin America, and hundreds of other people calling themselves the Water Protectors, are camped out in North Dakota as the winter sets in to protest the pipeline construction. Last week, the charge of participating in a riot was dropped by Judge John Greensteiner against journalist Amy Goodman of the television and radio show Democracy Now!, which is broadcast on nearly 1,200 stations. Earlier, the charge of trespass was withdrawn against her. She had been interviewing people, and her crew was filming an attack by private pipeline security armed with biting dogs who actually attacked the Native Americans. We speak again today with environmental attorney Jeff Haas, who has been part of the legal team representing the protesters. Jeff practices law in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and is the author of the book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton.
Jeff Haas, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Jeff, before we ask you about an update on the pipeline, we know that Iberia Hampton passed away. You were at the funeral in Chicago 2 weeks ago, and she, of course, was Fred Hampton's mother. I first learned about her by reading your book on the assassination of Fred Hampton, and she was just a wonderful woman, and I wondered whether you might reflect on her accomplishments and your relationship with her for a moment, please.
Well, I would be happy to. She was a wonderful woman, and I got to know her through representing the family at the civil rights suit around the murder and assassination of her son, Fred Hampton, in 1969. And so I actually went down with her to her hometown at one point to Fred's grave. But Iberia and her husband, Francis, grew up in Haynesville, Louisiana, on farms that their grandparents had been slaves on. And they moved to Chicago in the 40s, as similarly as many black people did, took jobs in factories on the west side of Chicago and raised a family. But Iberia Hampton was just a stalwart. She was a union leader at Corn Products. When there was a strike, she cooked for 250 striking workers. And she was a lot of the strength behind Fred Hampton, who was this tremendously dynamic and charismatic leader who was murdered by the police when he was barely 21 years old. And just through the years and through continuing to keep up a relationship with the family, I think for myself and for another attorney at People's Law Office, Flint Taylor, Iberia Hampton sort of became another mother to us too, and maybe we partially became sons to her. But whenever you went out there, there was always a lot of good Southern food and warmth and just support and caring, and the whole community felt that. And Iberia Hampton was just a stalwart in the community in Maywood, a working-class suburb west of Chicago. And her passing will be missed by all of us. She actually just passed away Sunday. So I happened to be in Chicago, and Flint Taylor and I went by and did see her surviving son and daughter. And already there were many people at the home. And she'll just be remembered with the warmth and strength and stubbornness that she also, her son Fred, picked up and was known for as well.
Let's talk about what's going on in North Dakota. We suffered a defeat a couple of weeks ago in the hands of the Court of Appeals, who dissolved the injunction that had been gotten against the ongoing construction. Can you bring us up to date on that, please?
Well, yes. The tribe had filed a lawsuit some time ago claiming that the permits for the Dakota Access Pipeline, which goes all the way from North Dakota down to Illinois, to transport 500,000 gallons per day of Bakken oil to the Midwest and maybe to the Gulf for export, had obtained permits to build this pipeline. But what they had not done it with the requirements of either going through the environmental protections necessary, nor had they consulted with the tribes whose land they went through for information about sacred sites, burial places, and so forth, all of which is required under the law. So the tribe was saying, take away these permits, require them to do a much more a real environmental study. After they actually lost the injunction in the lower court, but got a temporary restraining order against construction within 20 miles east and west of this lake, which is part of the Missouri River. And a few days ago, the court dissolved that, again saying, well, there had been minimum amount of consultation. It was all that the law required, and therefore they could go ahead and construct up to the Missouri River. Now, there remains in effect, they do not have a permit to go across the Missouri River right above the Standing Rock Reservation. The Army Corps of Engineers has said they are going to do some further study of that. Whether there's going to be a deep impact study or a superficial one remains to be seen. So as a result, the pipeline is, with winter approaching in North Dakota, they're trying to construct the pipeline on both sides of the Missouri right up to the river as rapidly as they can to try to get it in before winter. And the people at the camp, who are about 1,000 right now and goes up and down a little bit, was as high as 6,000 on Labor Day, people are going out and praying in front of the construction equipment, and some are actually locking down on the construction equipment and trying to stop the construction for the day. And the response of the law enforcement has been more and more militant, more armed. Actually, they're now appearing in riot gear, sometimes actually pointing weapons at people. And so the situation is becoming a tinderbox, and there are a lot of people getting arrested. Now people get arrested just for going out on the road to try to find the places where the construction is going on and being brought in on what was formerly disorderly charges. And now if they're actually in the field or something, they're trying to charge them with riot, which was what they tried to change Amy Goodman of Democracy Now's charge to.
And Jeff, we understand a judge dropped those charges, but read also that when protesters came out, when they heard about the riot charges, they were doused with pepper spray, dogs had been used against them. Is that tenor of treatment of protesters continuing?
On September 3rd, that's when the security guards for the pipeline actually did use dogs to confront people who were protesting, and at least seven people were bitten by the dogs. And we are in the process of preparing lawsuits for the victims of that. They have kept their dogs in their car more recently, and there haven't been incidents of pepper spray. When Amy Goodman was supposed to turn herself in on Monday, and there was a large rally outside the courthouse, there were at least 100 officers in, looked like in riot gear with full helmets and batons and face masks. So they're definitely upping it. And they're also, when people get arrested, they're strip searching everybody, even on disorderly conduct charges, which is a misdemeanor. So people come in, and the men and the women are made to strip search, reports of sometimes the women being strip searched with men watching them. And it's just another form of harassment. They're also trying to raise the bail on the charges. So it seems like law enforcement is becoming an arm of the pipeline, trying to help them get the pipe laid before winter sets in. And the constitutional rights to protest and assemble of the demonstrators or the water protectors are being ignored.
Jeff Haas, we learned that the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, David Archibald, was strip searched, and the pediatrician, a woman named Dr. Jumping Eagle, was also strip searched. And then we also learned that the actress Shailene Woodley, listeners will remember she played the part of Edward Snowden's girlfriend in the movie Snowden. And she was picked out. She wasn't even demonstrating. She was leaving. And they went and they got her. And she said, "Why me?" And they said, "Because we know who you are." And they took her and they not only strip searched her, but they did a cavity search as well.
Yeah, that's a form of extreme harassment that is happening. And they are selective sometimes in who they pick. They arrested Amy Goodman because she got the dramatic footage of the dogs with blood on their mouths after they had bitten people. And they have gone and picked other people. Cody Hall, who was also charged with Amy Goodman, was picked out because he was a leader. Now, there were 200 people out there stopping the bulldozers that day or standing in the way and trying to protect them from destroying sacred sites. But they picked Cody Hall because he was a leader inside the camp and a spokesperson. They picked Amy Goodman because she was filming. And they did with Shailene Woodley also. They picked people who I think they want to make an example of. And, the demeaning strip search, and it's absurd in a disorderly conduct case where you're going to get out either the same within a few hours if you happen to be there when the court gets your bond, but to go through a strip search is just a tremendous amount of hassle. And, of course, it's very demeaning, and particularly to the women, and if there are men guards present or in the vicinity. So this is pretty unusual and outrageous behavior.
Also outrageous was the arrest of Amy Goodman. I wanted you to talk about that because she was first charged with trespass, and that charge was dropped. And then she was charged with rioting. Charging a journalist with rioting, I think, is particularly egregious because not only do journalists have a right to report, but the public has a right to learn and to hear and to see. And it seems like because Amy's coverage has been so widely picked up that they went after her for that. And I wanted to ask you, what kind of coverage is the protest getting in the corporate media?
Well, in corporate media, it's not getting very much. When Amy got the footage and she came up here and was there the day the dog biting happened, and I was there and saw her go and actually film and confront some of the security guards whose dogs were biting people and asking them, or confronting them, do you know what they're doing? Her videos went viral and were picked up by the major networks. So the networks were then here when we were waiting the decision from D.C. on the injunction. But by and large, other than social media and Democracy Now!, I think that the Standing Rock has slipped off the radar of the main media, apparently covering Trump and Hillary's indiscretions ad infinitum is more important. But we have a really, I think, a dangerous situation up here. The Bismarck paper today had three articles in it. One was about how the camp needs to dig in for the winter. That was a fairly decent article. Another article said a claim that somebody was shooting arrows, a farmer, at cows. And this seems like the kind of thing that, why would anybody from the camp do that? It just seems like it's an effort to anger the farmers and ranchers around here, and somebody who would be nutty enough to do that, who would benefit from that, the Dakota Access Pipeline. And the other thing is the sheriff up here, Kyle Kirschmeyer, has been releasing these reports of how dangerous the protesters are. And today he had a story on the criminal backgrounds of the protesters, listing how many times people had been arrested for similar activity, usually almost always around environmental issues. But the way it's portrayed is they have this many misdemeanors, they're from out of state, or this many arrests. And so they're trying to portray the protesters as the judge up here called a bunch of hooligans, as opposed to really people who are concerned about the environment, protection of the water and sacred sites, and who are nonviolent, who are committed to nonviolent direct action. Even when they lock themselves down to equipment, they have the instructions with them how to get them off of the equipment safely for both law enforcement and themselves. And their purpose is not to harm anyone or even harm the equipment, but they are committed to stopping the construction of this really dangerous, deadly pipeline that will allow oil in Bakken to get out and to be burned at some place in the world, as well as these pipelines carry the certainty of leaks in their 1,300 miles crossing both the Mississippi and the Missouri River, threatening the drinking water of millions of people. So I feel like the people here are really dedicated. They are committed to nonviolence. In many cases, they're praying in front or singing in front of the construction equipment. And the response is becoming more and more military.
Jeff, the response that you're describing mirrors what we saw during the Occupy movement across the country, during protests at the RNC and DNC, where false information is planted in the press and then used as justification, for example, in the case of Occupy, to tear down a lot of the encampments. Are people preparing for a worst-case scenario that would be raising of the encampment, bringing in, say, even more militarized forces?
I think that's a possibility. I think as long as there's 1,000 or more people there, it would take a lot of law enforcement. Now, that's another thing. The federal government has refused to give National Guard troops to this effort of law enforcement. So the sheriff here has called for sheriff's department and law enforcement all over the country to join him in this effort. That's a possibility, a frontal attack on the camp. I kind of think it's more dangerous. Some provocateur or somebody who reads the kind of stuff the sheriff and other people put out, something happens, some rancher or farmer fires a shot, or they hear a backfire of a car, or something happens that really sets off a violent response by law enforcement at one of these protests. I think Occupy is an example. Sometimes I think it could be a little bit like what we watched, the prelude to what happened at Attica, when the men were demanding human rights in Attica prison, and the situation was escalating. And eventually, of course, there was a slaughter by the state troopers. I fear that something like that could be brewing, probably not an all-out assault, but some single incident sets off something, and we could have a lot of violence and a lot of Native Americans and their supporters hurt. And if people can come up here, particularly we need people who are legal observers and people who are lawyers to come up to camp and other people to help, whether it's chopping wood or in the kitchen, and to get the word out of what's going on. If they know sympathetic local media people, then let, you know, let us know who they are, and we can get them the stories. I think the camp, Facebook, if you go to Red Facebook page, Red Warrior Camp, there is a lot of things being put out on social media. But I think, by and large, corporate media is ignoring what's going on here.
This is a huge corporate project. There's $3.8 billion involved here. And I'm remembering when the Occupy camps were shut down. One of them is just a block and a half away from where I live. But they were shut down simultaneously from one end of the country to the other in an effort that was coordinated by the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI with the knowledge and probably the direction of the White House. And what I'm concerned about is after 9/11, a law was passed allowing the National Guard of one state to be brought in and used in another state. And with this big corporate money at risk here, because they've got loans, if the project is stalled, they're paying interest on the loans. There's going to be a lot of pressure on the federal government to do something about this. And I'm concerned that after the election, there may be a real national push to close down the water protectors. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that it's interesting. I think Obama has tried to walk a middle road here. In one instance is the Department of Energy and the Department of Justice and the Department of Interior urged the pipeline not to do construction right near the camp voluntarily, even though there was no court order prohibiting it. They have ignored that. Somehow I kind of think Obama does not want this confrontation to get worse or get more violent on his watch. And so the government has sort of not taken a position of either protecting the, of prohibiting the pipeline, or taking away most of the major permits for it. Nor have they allowed the permit for going under the Missouri River, which could be a last piece of it. They've sort of been neutral. But yes, certainly, if Trump were to win, we would see probably an immediate siege. Hillary is known for supporting fracking, and I'm not sure, but what you talk about is quite possible that there could be a federal government. This is a real, as you mentioned, this is $3.8 billion pipeline, and there's a lot of corporate money here, and there's a lot of bank loans here, and every day that the pipeline gets delayed, it's costing the companies more money. So they're in a race to not have their loans defaulted and also to finish the pipeline before winter sets in North Dakota. On the other hand, the people here are very determined to not allow this pipeline to go under their lake and their Missouri River, and to try to stop that in any nonviolent way they can.
Attorney Jeff Haas, we've come to the end of our allotted time. We thank you very much for your time teaching us about what's going on in North Dakota.
And as I said, people can go to Sacred Stone Camp and contribute to the legal efforts. We have over 140 arrests thus far. We're posting bail for people. We're trying to get lawyers for people. And as in any other ways that people can publicize what's going on here would be very helpful.
Thank you so much, Jeff Haas. We'll stay tuned to you and get back to you for another update in the near future. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for covering this. It's a very important story, and it's only escalating.
Bye-bye, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting interviews with presidential candidates other than those from the two major parties. Last week, we had Jeff Mackler from the Socialist Action Organization. This week, we have Gloria LaRiva, who's on the ballot under the ticket of the Peace and Freedom Party in California, running with Native American activist Dennis Banks. She's also running on the Party for Socialism and Liberation ticket with Eugene Puryear in many other states. For many years, Gloria LaRiva was the head of the committee to save the Cuban Five. She's been a union activist in San Francisco and a lifelong fighter for social justice.
Gloria LaRiva, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
Gloria, why are you running for president when you know you can't win?
Well, as a socialist, I believe that we must use every venue to reach out to people on vital matters that affect all our lives, whether it's protests or, you know, education, marches. Every venue of struggle must be utilized. And the presidential elections in the U.S. are a powerful magnet. This year, people are drawn to it out of fear and trepidation more than any confidence in the candidates. But we have to be there, too, to counter the lies and the hidden truths by the Democrats and Republicans to provide an alternative. I think 2016 is the year in which more and more people are looking to third parties for an alternative, because it, just on the issue of the primaries, only 9% of the people in the U.S. voted in the primaries for either candidate of Democrats or Republicans. And I think that for the people that we meet through media, through the streets and our outreach, it's been a real eye-opener to hear our proposals, our perspective on the issues and on socialism.
Gloria, speaking of the primaries, do you think Bernie Sanders was really talking about political revolution or democratic socialism?
I think his political revolution was mainly on the issue of real access to the elections, democracy, which we later find out his claims of the manipulation and conspiracy by the Democrat leadership was, in fact, true. But I think his campaign was an important development, unexpected to be sure, because he did say he was a socialist as he raised health care, free schooling. And whatever his definition was, it did help socialists like us. He comes from the tendency of democratic socialism that he himself defined earlier in the year as not taking over the means of production. But we say that you can't just control or tie down the oil companies with laws or reforms, because they spend billions to fight the politicians who stand in their way, if there are any. So it is necessary, we believe, to take over the means of production, to nationalize the banks and use all the wealth that they squander from the people. We say take that capital that comes from loan shark interest rates, from foreclosures, from their fraud, and use it to fund a whole new society, to rebuild the infrastructure. So I think that's our difference with Sanders. But I think the question was, even with his contradictions, his record in supporting war funding in the past, the question was, what is our approach to his movement and to the people who supported him? So, my party and my supporters, we were engaging them in a very positive way, saying we're glad to see what you're doing, we salute you, support you. But in the end, if he's not the nominee, join the movement that continues. And that, in fact, has taken place, because it's a movement beyond Sanders, beyond any, really. I think that Sanders believed and felt that it was time to run on his platform because of Occupy, the fight for 15, Black Lives Matter. It's this new change that we've seen in the recent years.
As you've been campaigning, what response have you gotten to the argument that, quote, this time Clinton really is a lesser evil because Trump is characterized as everything from an open racist, sexist, misogynist, anti-immigrant, and Islamophobic bigot, if not a fascist?
I completely agree that Donald Trump is a misogynist, racist, everything you're saying. He's despicable and he's poison. But Hillary Clinton is not the antidote to Trump. And I think the last debate was very revealing in that regard. the release of this horrendous audio tape of Trump's sexual abuse of women was, in fact, timed by those supporters of her. And no doubt it should be exposed. But it was timed right before the second debate to hopefully put the last nail in his coffin. But I believe especially to cover up the major scandal that was openly announced ahead of time by Julian Assange of the WikiLeaks emails and the secret conversations with Goldman Sachs, just one issue alone. And what did she say to Goldman Sachs? She said to them, don't worry if I criticize you publicly, if I criticize the banks, because there's a public side to what I say and a private side. And more than that even is with the Clinton presidency, which is very likely, we face a very heightened danger of war. She's made clear in her two debates and previously called for the overthrow of Syrian President Assad, calling for direct bombing by the U.S. and preceded by the no-fly zone that she and John Kerry are pushing for. No-fly zone means Syrian government cannot fly to defend itself, but we can fly to bomb. It's an astonishing proposal to engage in the destruction of another new state that doesn't hew to the line of the U.S. and another country in the Middle East that's been ravaged by the U.S. intervention. Now, we have to remind ourselves that before 2003, Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra, the Islamic group, the Islamic State, none of the groups existed before, but they continue to be armed by the U.S., including Secretary of State Clinton under Obama's second term, authorized the funding of weapons to Qatar, an ally of Al-Qaeda, which helped lead to the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi. What a disaster she created in Libya that she still boasts about having forced Obama to carry out. And her foreign policy will be that of the neocons. I want to recommend that people look up the Campaign for a New American Strategy. And this is the blueprint for the foreign policy of Clinton if she becomes president. The CEO of this Campaign for a New American Strategy is Michel Flournoy, and who is a direct neocon, Robert Kagan, who's considered the godfather of the neoconservatives, who's raising millions for Clinton. And Kagan's wife is Victoria Nuland, who had been top advisor to Cheney. When Clinton became Secretary of State, she appointed Victoria Nuland as her spokesperson. And then Obama appointed her as the Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasia, and she played a key role in the coup of Ukraine. So Hillary Clinton, in her second debate, showed that what she intends is plain fire in regard to Russia, which could lead to a nuclear war, a third world war, because you're not just taking on the overthrow of Syria. You are taking on a country which has been effective in fighting ISIS and the terrorist groups. You know, it's a very, very serious matter. So what a terrible choice people have, Trump or Clinton. And I think that's why third parties like Jill Stein and myself and others as well are getting such a hearing. I do not hear, by the way, people saying, I got to vote for the lesser evil. I mean, there certainly is that, I will say that. But people are not telling us, you're wasting the vote. Why are you doing this? People are actually listening to us.
As a leader of the Committee to Free the Cuban Five, what is your assessment of the new Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, I think it's an extremely important movement. For years now, there have been record killings by the police of Black and Latino youth, and you know all people who they've murdered but Black and Latino by disproportionate numbers because of racial profiling and pure racist hatred by those cops who do kill. But it took the rebellion and the sustained protests in Ferguson that marked a turning point in the movement, and which out of arose Black Lives Matter. And sadly, there have been between 2,500 and 3,000 killings since Michael Brown was murdered, with virtually total impunity by the police. The protests have continued. They've started to change the consciousness of the wider population only because of the protests. It needs to continue. Every week we see more killings. It can be anywhere in the United States. And it's an outrage. I believe that the way to stop the killings is to jail the police, to jail them immediately and carry out a serious prosecution. But it will take the rebellion of the people.
Gloria, let me just get back for a moment to your position on Syria. What do you think the United States should do with respect to Syria?
I think they should do in Syria what they do in, what I think they should do in the whole world, get out. Because the U.S. created the situation. The Syria's crime is that it was independent of U.S. imperialism, U.S. banks, the influence of U.S. corporations, and European as well. It is a point of resistance to the wider aims of the United States in geopolitical terms in the Middle East. While the U.S. is funding more and more Israel, they see Syria as an obstacle to total domination in the Middle East. It is Syria where Palestinians still have refuge, the Palestinian movement. It's not just Syria. It was the previous country of Libya, Iraq, and Iran is also next after Syria. So it's very, very serious. We say that the U.S. should just get out. I know that people look at it and say, well, you know, terrorism, but the U.S. created this terrorist situation. The U.S. is the terrorist in the Middle East. I think it's very unfortunate that some people in the left, in the progressive movement, are confused on this matter. And we should just take the lesson of what took place has now occurred in Libya, the complete breakdown of what was a stable government. And Libya, which was an African, northern African country, and was proposing moving for the unity of African countries against the European and United States reconquest of that continent.
The U.S. recently granted Israel $38 billion for military defense over the next decade. Where do you stand on this issue?
Well, we're completely in support of the Palestinian struggle for self-determination, and it's appalling the $38 billion for more weapons, demolishing homes, expelling Palestinians, endangering the whole people of Palestine. And it's clear the U.S. used to pretend that it was a broker and trying to bring the two sides together. One is the oppressor, Israel, and the Palestinians are the oppressed. But every day you see on the social media, because you don't see it in the main news, how many Palestinians are being murdered, shot down, brutalized. It's really horrifying. And so the $38 billion is aiding Israel to that cause of genocide. And then you see Netanyahu saying, we want more. I mean, we don't stop. That's in addition to the $4 billion from the U.S. every year. And Clinton has said, I will embrace Netanyahu if I become president. And this is why the BDS movement, the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement against Israel and for the Palestinian people is so critical. We can and must play a greater role in supporting that and challenging Clinton, stopping Clinton's attempt to overturn BDS. Now you see New York State has weighed in against the BDS movement. In California, the governor has on his desk a bill to also apply pressure against the BDS movement. This is where we're seeing the conflict increasing greatly.
How do you assess the accusations of Russian spying?
It's a joke, really. It's an amazing accusation from Washington, the government that has spied not only on all of us, but on its own allies, the total surveillance of the world, including on Russia. And to claim that Russia spied on the Democrats' emails, on Clinton's emails, to affect the election is so ridiculous. Nothing could affect the election more than the two candidates themselves and their ridiculous posturing and campaign and fight with each other. But the reasoning behind the accusations on Russian spying is what is very worrisome. And if we look at the last 2 years, but especially the last few months, the Olympics, the demonizing of Russian athletes, claiming that they were just massively doping, when we find out later that key U.S. athletes in the Olympics were given exemptions to be able to use the same drugs that are prohibited. They could do it, but not the Russians, and even the Paralympics. Then you find the U.S. Accusing Russia of everything. So I think it's creating the groundwork, the political propaganda, in order to wage this war in Syria, and to further encroach on former Soviet territory. The U.S. acts as if Russia is on our border, but it's the United States that has, along with NATO forces, heavy military equipment on the border of Russia. And this is a great danger. It is Russia that lost 27 million people in World War II, fighting the Nazis, fighting the invasion. You know, we have a lot of work to do in the political movement to expose what is really taking place in regard to U.S.-Russia relations.
Gloria LaRiva, I'd like to shift our attention, if we could, back to the Western Hemisphere. You're running for president now, but in the past you've been one of the leading activists in the Cuban solidarity support work, and particularly with freeing the Cuban Five. And last month, Obama signed legislation continuing the blockade of Cuba. I think that people generally think that relations have now become normalized with Cuba. You can go there, you can look around, so things are back to where they should be. But that's not the case, and I wanted to know what you've been able to do on the campaign trail about that issue.
Yes, thank you, Michael. It actually is a major misconception. When I talk to people about Cuba, they're like, oh, yeah, now we can travel. The blockade's still in place. They call it the embargo. Very much in place. And in fact, the claims of Clinton that Cuba can now have bank accounts in the U.S. and have normal transactions is, in fact, totally not true. But on the campaign trail, we talk about these issues, that not only should all U.S. bases be shut down, but immediately, especially, close down the prison in Guantanamo, return Cuba's territory of roughly 47 square miles back to Cuba. There is going to be a vote at the U.N. on October 26th. Once again, since 1992, Cuba has won majority vote. This time, it'll likely only be two countries, the U.S. and Israel, to vote in support of the U.S. blockade. It's very, very harmful. And we need to look beyond, also, Cuba and see what the U.S. is doing in Venezuela. How Obama's term started out in 2009 with the coup in Honduras that, again, Clinton was largely responsible for, and the attempt to turn back the progress, the great progress that has been taking place in Latin America these last, actually, 15 years, and the reversal that we're unfortunately seeing, the U.S. influence in the election of Macri, President Macri in Argentina, the overturning of Dilma Rousseff's presidency in Brazil. It's a very, very serious matter for Latin America, and we need to be in solidarity with those movements to help also expose the truth of what's taking place in Venezuela, the economic war that's going on. It's the primary cause for the problems, but also the great exaggeration in the U.S. media about the problems in Venezuela. They want the messages that socialism doesn't work. And in fact, when you look right now, that Cuba has 800 medical doctors in Haiti, in the part that was affected by this terrible Hurricane Matthew. You don't see now what's really taking place. Over 1,000 people died in Haiti. And the U.S. Really helping to impoverish Haiti even more under Clinton's term. And I want to say that as Secretary of State, it's important, again, to keep emphasizing Clinton's history. When there was a move and an attempt in Haiti's parliament to raise the minimum wage from something like 23 cents to 60 cents an hour for Haitian workers, the U.S. State Department, under Clinton, forced the increase to be only somewhat like 31 cents an hour. And this impoverishment is not a natural occurrence. It is U.S. made in Haiti. And so I salute Cuba for what they're doing in Haiti with their great, great medical support.
Gloria, we just have a few minutes left. We wanted to ask you, since the economic crash in this country, our government has spent tens of trillions of dollars to bail out failing banks and corporations. What is your position on the success of these bailouts?
The success has strictly been the enrichment of the banks and their executives. And I think the public saw how their bonuses just increased by tens of millions, that nobody was really bailed out. The foreclosures, there were 3 million foreclosures of American homes. and the fraudulent practices and the maximization of these banks' profits, their mergers, and so on, has not only continued, it has accelerated. And even U.S. economists are warning that there is another collapse developing. It could very well take place soon. Who knows when? We cannot predict this. But we know this, that the banks will again demand a bailout. And I don't think that the American public will accept it, nor should we. But I want to talk on the larger issue of the wealth of this country. There are $13 trillion in offshore tax shelters of the Fortune 500 and others, companies like Apple, Google. Goldman Sachs has over 900 tax shelters abroad, and over 500 of them are in Bahamas. So on the issue of just taxing those companies' wealth abroad that they pay no taxes on to the U.S., it would be $717 billion in 1 year alone. And so you are scratching the surface when we talk about the wealth of the United States, the wealth that the working class has created. These bankers don't create the wealth. They're just, you know, speculating on the hard work of the American people and the exploitation of people abroad. So when you explain this to the American public, the people we've talked to, on some of these simple facts, Trump is not the only one who was rescued by hundreds of millions of dollars in tax breaks and grants from New York City. How many jobs could be created in New York? But he's just one of thousands of billionaires. So we say that, yes, we can fight for reforms while we're living in this system, but ultimately we truly need socialism, a system where the wealth of the people is shared, where the people have the decision-making role, and where the wealth is used. What we produce and what we don't produce. We don't need new luxury cars every year. We need mass transportation. We don't need to be foreclosing and bulldozing homes in neighborhoods that go empty because people can't live there anymore. We need to give people homes based on need and not profit. A home should be a personal property and not real estate. So those are the kind of things we're raising and why we're not on the debates, why we don't get major media coverage on television. Because if we, myself, Jill Stein and others were on television alongside Clinton and Trump, I think we would rock their world. And I think that we would have not just votes, but we would have the ability to help create and develop and support the movement that we're seeing already on the upsurge. Black Lives Matter, Fight for 15, the women's movement, which must strengthen because we are so under attack. Women are under attack not just by Trump, but politicians who want to take away our rights, to abortion and health care, and other rights as well. Equality, equal pay.
Gloria LaRiva, we're running out of our allotted time, but I wanted to ask you one last question, and I think it's probably the most profound issue we have facing us, and that's, of course, global warming. What is the position of your party, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, are out in California, Peace and Freedom? What is your position on global warming? What should the United States government be doing now?
Well, first, global warming is real, and we see the effects every day, and they're intensifying. The rising of the sea levels, the acidification of the oceans that are raising the specter of disappearance of major species of sea life that could bring a major collapse. I think it's underway already. You can read it in the news. But it's because of capitalist production that's created the crisis, the oil, gas, coal, plastics, the gargantuan food industry that's out of control. I could go on and on, but at the root of the crisis is capitalist overproduction. It's not a rhetorical response to say that a sustainable planning is what's needed to use the resources of the earth rationally. It's the whole panorama of capitalism, the day in and out advertising. I live in California, where we went on a tour through the valley months ago on the issue of the drought. Not just drought of nature, but the fact that the agribusiness is sucking all the water out of thousands of years of accumulation underground, and people don't have water in their homes. We see now the flooding along the Mississippi. The flooding in Baton Rouge, because of the flooding a few months ago, just by the rain, you know, we have electors in Louisiana who helped us get on the ballot. They're living in cars. These were people who had homes, They were working, and now they're living in cars because the U.S. government is not helping them. So global warming is international. It's worldwide. And it must be arrested and countered by a sustainable, planned economy and society. And that's what we're fighting for. At this very moment when even the corporations understand the danger, but that they've hidden, Exxon hid this crisis since the 1970s, and yet they will not stop their production of oil. They will not stop the fracking. And that's why in the environmental movement, the most important development today is that's taking place at Standing Rock Reservation. I've been there. My vice presidential candidate in the Western States, Dennis Banks, is there permanently. And we must support the Standing Rock resistance of hundreds of Native nations. It is the new environmental movement, environmental justice, and we should all salute them and continue helping their winter camp, because they're going to keep fighting.
Well, Gloria LaRiva, we on Law and Disorder salute you for your campaign as president, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much, and I support you and your program and everything that you do to bring out the truth to the people. Thank you. And if people want to know how to get hold of us, they can check out GloriaLaRivaForPresident.com, and four is a number, GloriaLaRivaForPresident.com.
It's just been a tremendous pleasure for us to be able to interview a person with your ideas. Thank you so much, and good luck to you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.